rounded up in Moscow today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Hundreds were arrested in Russia following protests against Putin and his cronies, and this American reporter was jailed too.
I was asking on what grounds they had detained an American journalist. The lieutenant in charge told me, maybe you killed Kennedy. This was a joke. This was just an example of kind of how dismissive and kind of glib they were being about the whole thing.
Plus, war and famine ravaged South Sudan.
Women and children are running out of food. There is no water and there's insecurity. So they are all coming to the refugee camp in Kenya.
And what makes a Dane a Dane?
If you're born in Denmark and you're not of fair skin, you're going to be told you're not Danish.
Those stories and more coming up today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Glad you could be here this Monday. We've got stories from two American cities today, San Francisco, with its own form of universal health care that covers undocumented immigrants, and Buffalo, New York, where immigrants and refugees are helping to create new sustainable housing. But we start with a place that's been on our minds a lot lately, Russia. There are all those allegations about election interference and Russia's ties to the Trump campaign. Right now, though, we're talking about the news from Russia. Big protests there yesterday, and not just in major cities like Moscow and St. Petersburg. Demonstrators rallied all across the country to denounce government corruption, and police arrested hundreds of people for protesting without permission. Today, some of them, including the main organizer, got jail sentences. Charles Maines was at the protests in Moscow and sent us this report.
Going into Sunday, nobody really knew how many people would show up for this so-called anti-corruption rally. Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny organized the event using just social media, and that was done to highlight a YouTube investigation Navalny published about the Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev's lavish lifestyle. In the video, Navalny alleges Medvedev misappropriated funds for charity organizations to acquire a yacht, a vineyard, and several mansions, even one with a separate house for his pet ducks, which is why some protesters were carrying rubber duckies. The Russian government and state media have ignored the story altogether. But protester Ilya Fyodorov says he was shocked into action by the video. He's a student at a Moscow university and says he never really engaged in politics, but now he wants to see an investigation. Younger Russians seemed to dominate Sunday's rallies. Despite threats from the authorities, they would face fines and imprisonment. Many were swept up in the police raids, along with Navalny and other organizers. Today, a Russian court sentenced Navalny to 15 days in prison. Authorities will now have to decide whether they want to be as strict with young Russians caught up in the melee. But analyst Fyodor Kreshenynikov says the real story is this is a new generation. These young Russians have grown up with Putin as their president, but don't share the same level of respect for him as their parents. For these young people, Putin's not sacred. He's the old guy they show on their parents' television sets, says Kreshenynikov. Navalny has already announced he's running for the presidency in 2018, and Kreshenynikov says these young Russians are his natural electorate. In a phone call with reporters today, Putin's spokesman Dmitry Peskov insisted the Kremlin was analyzing the scale of the protests and accused Navalny of luring young Russians, children he called them, onto the streets with promises of money. Peskov also defended Moscow's riot police, saying they acted highly professionally, and state media's coverage of the protests, which was all but non-existent. Russian television channels have total editorial independence, said Peskov, and they report what they think is important and meaningful. Indeed, Russia's state channel's lead story Monday was about a nasty shift in weather. No fake news here. After a spring Sunday, winter was back again. Only it may leave those who attended Sunday's rallies wondering whether viewers missed the generational shift unfolding before their eyes. For The World, Charles Maines, Moscow.
Reporter Alec Loon went out to cover the protests in Moscow yesterday for The Guardian newspaper. He ended up getting arrested himself. Where were you when the police arrested you, and what were you doing?
Well, I had followed a crowd down this side street off the main street where the protest was happening. When I was doing that, all of a sudden, riot police standing near where I was at the end of this side street started detaining people. I turned around, lifted my phone to take a photo of this, and as soon as I did that, I was grabbed by a riot policeman and patted down. They threw me in a police van. even though this entire time I was repeating in Russian, I'm a foreign journalist. Mm. I'm a foreign journalist who is simply doing my job.
Were you asking them why they were in the process of arresting you?
Yeah, well, at first I was just saying that I'm a foreign journalist, thinking that they would immediately let me go. When that didn't happen, I started to try and ask what were the grounds on which I was being detained and other people were being detained, because the entire protest up to this point had been extremely peaceful, very quiet. People weren't even holding signs or chanting slogans.
And this is all happening in the center of Moscow near Red Square.
In the center of Moscow, Tverskaya Ulitsa, Tverskaya Street, where this is happening, is the kind of main street of Moscow. It goes right by the mayor's office, straight down to Red Square. But because it hadn't been approved by the city authorities, they refused to approve it. So people weren't carrying all the signs and normal paraphernalia you'd expect to see at the protests. Nonetheless, riot police seemed to just be scared by the number of people who had showed up in the thousands and started detaining people to try to intimidate protesters.
So what happened while you were in police custody?
Well, once there were 17 people in this police bus, we were taken to a police station on the outskirts of Moscow where they had a long table of police officers who were filling out the charges against us. A lot of these protesters were very young. A lot of them had been detained much more roughly than I had. One young man who was 15 years old was bleeding from cuts in his neck and his nose. He said he'd been kicked by police. They threw him to the ground and kicked him, he said. So they started filling out these charges against us. I was asking on what grounds they had detained an American journalist. The lieutenant in charge told me, maybe you killed Kennedy.
Was that a joke or were they strangely
serious? The lieutenant told me.
Yeah,
this was a joke. This was just an example of kind of how dismissive and kind of glib they were being about the whole thing. One officer was telling us that he told me that I had been shouting slogans and that was why I was here. And I said, well, I didn't shout any slogans. And secondly, how could you possibly know that among the more than 1,000 arrests that happened? Making all sorts of strange accusations. And in the end, we were all charged with holding an unsanctioned rally, which is an administrative offense that can carry a large fine. Later, the foreign ministry intervened on my behalf and they say they have gotten those charges dropped. But again, the protesters who I was detained with, many of them very young, in their late teens, early 20s, they will be summoned to court. And I was speaking to some of them today. They're planning to fight these charges because they believe the police abused their power and that there were many violations in the process. One kid in the police van was asking if they thought he was going to get kicked out of university.
Were there bystanders also rounded up? Because there are some photos posted online of a young woman who claims she was only walking from a McDonald's with her mother.
I think there were definitely bystanders also rounded up. I spoke to one man who was an engineer who said he was simply walking from the metro. He saw police detaining a man. He thought that they were being too violent with the man, so he started chanting shame with a couple other people. And when he did that, they detained him as well and punched him twice in the back. And he said to me he hadn't planned to be a part of the protest. He just happened to be there as a passerby. But he said, next time I am going to come to the protest, I am going to participate.
Reporter Alec Loon with The Guardian got caught up in the protest yesterday in Moscow, arrested and then released. Thanks so much for your time, Alec.
My pleasure.
Let's turn now to the possible ties between Russia and the Trump administration. Senators on the Intelligence Committee want to question Trump's son-in-law and trusted advisor, Jared Kushner, about meetings he had with the Russian ambassador and also a meeting he attended with an official from a Russian state-owned bank. Politico's Lewis Nelson has been reporting on this, and he joins us now. What do we know at this point about Kushner's contact with the Russians?
The sort of new revelations today are, first, the Senate Intelligence Committee is planning to question Jared Kushner about these meetings. And the meetings are the other thing that are sort of new information today. There were two of them, like you mentioned, one with the Russian ambassador to the United States. This is the same Russian ambassador that met with Attorney General Jeff Sessions. The
Mr.
same
Kislyak,
Russian ambassador.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. The same guy who met as well with Michael Flynn, the former national security advisor who was forced to resign. Mm. This is a guy who's been at the center of a lot of different controversies for the White House thus far.
I mean, the Senate investigation is only one of several investigations into whether the White House is colluding or had been colluding with Russia. Where in the thermometer of concern is Kushner's dealings with Russians right now?
You know, I don't know that it rises above any of the other concerns. There are the sort of larger, more conspiratorial relationships between Russia, Russian officials, and people like Paul Manafort, the former campaign chairman for Donald Trump. People like Roger Stone, who is a sort of longtime confidant and advisor to the president. People like Carter Page, a former foreign policy advisor to President Trump's campaign.
What exactly was Jared Kushner's role during the campaign, the transition, and now in the White House?
You know, throughout, Jared Kushner has always been a very close confidant of President Trump. Before Donald Trump entered the political world and took on all of these extra staff and extra people, he's always relied on people who he feels are loyal to him, people who he feels very close to, has a trusted relationship with. And Jared Kushner has been one of those people for a long time.
And now he's got his own office in the White House, a SWAT team, they're calling it, to bring some efficiencies to government. Has there ever been a figure like Jared Kushner in U.S. politics? Is this unprecedented?
Well, in terms of the sort of specifics of this, I don't know that there's ever been a son-in-law who's been hired as a sort of senior level like this, not to mention the fact that Donald Trump's daughter, Jared Kushner's wife, Ivanka Trump, also has this sort of undefined role in the White House, either has a West Wing office or is soon moving into a West Wing office, even though she is not a federal government employee, does not have an official role with the White House. There are sort of a lot of unique roles, unique relationships in this White House, but I think that speaks to the different ways that Donald Trump has chosen to staff the White House, chosen to build up a staff around himself, and sort of the relationships and people that he trusts.
With Jared Kushner having his own office in the White House now and kind of these efficiencies in government mission of his, does that mean he's going to be less present on Israel and Mideast issues?
You know, I think that remains to be seen whether or not this new role as running this government efficiency SWAT team ends up taking him away from his already very full plate, doing a lot of the diplomatic things that you outlined. He is one of the lead advisors on the Middle East peace process. You know, I think it remains to be seen how much, too, this new role that he's taking on, this new team that he's taking on, will actually be able to accomplish. This is certainly not the first time that a president has come into office and said that he intends to reform the federal bureaucracy and make it run more like a business. Al Gore did something like this under President Bill Clinton. This has been done during the Reagan administration as well. It's hard to think of one that's really left a big imprint on the federal government. The government very much does not run like a business.
Politico's Lewis Nelson, thank you very much for your time and your thoughts today.
It's a pleasure, Marco. Thank you.
And just ahead, immigrants in Denmark and what it means to be Danish. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. A video out of Denmark has gone viral across Europe, and it's touched off a debate about whether the children of immigrants are considered European. That video struck a chord with The World's Rupa Shenoy.
It starts with this music and three kids in separate shots taking a seat in front of a white background. Abdi is 11. His black hair is buzzed short and his ears stick out. Nine-year-old Sarah has long brown curly hair, cute gaps between her teeth, and a skeptical expression. Rattle's 9 too. He has a mini pompadour, like a little Elvis. Scarlett's the youngest at 7. Her hair's pulled back into two ponytails. From off screen, a voice asks each kid where they're from.
Hvor kommer du fra?
They say Denmark.
Jeg kommer fra Danmark.
Looking around with expressions that say, what's this about?
Denmark.
The voice says, are you sure?
Er du sikker?
And they're like, yeah.
Yeah.
The voice says, why?
Hvorfor?
And they say, because I was born here, and because I was raised here, and because they have friends here. And the voice says,
nej, du ikke dansk.
No, you're not Danish. Rattle, the little Elvis, asks, why not? The voice says, people can't just come to Denmark, have kids, and say that those kids are Danish. Rattle thinks about it and says again, why not? The voice doesn't say anything, and Rattle just stares at whomever's behind the camera, getting sad. Sarah reacts the same way, confused and suddenly unconfident. Abdi says, "But I feel Danish."
Jeg føler mig dansk.
Scarlett, the youngest, starts to cry. She looks at someone behind the camera, a little resentfully. Then she tucks her head down and curls to her side, trying to hide. Some words appear, superimposed on the background. They say, "Politicians, please remember who you're talking about." Those words were written by Scarlett's father, who also shot the video. He's been accused of child abuse because of it. We'll get to that. But first, I'll explain why I identified like crazy with these kids. Any kid of an immigrant who resettled across the world over the last 50 years probably would too. Because Scarlett's just at that age when we begin to understand that people see us as different. I had one solid thing to fall back on, and that was my American citizenship, granted at birth in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. I understood how important it was. In the U.S., any citizen of any culture is American. In Denmark, that's not necessarily the case. Scarlett is a citizen of Denmark, but last month the Danish parliament issued a statement that seemed to say only those immigrants and their children from Western countries really count as quote-unquote Danish. These were the exact words. Quote, "Today, there are areas in Denmark where the proportion of immigrants and descendants from non-Western countries is over 50%. Parliament believes that Danes should not be in the minority in neighborhoods in Denmark," unquote.
When I saw that, you can't not get worried.
This is Scarlett's dad, Alex Sabor. He was born in Tehran and took the statement from Parliament personally. Even though some lawmakers apologized for the wording, saying it was clumsy, Sabor felt like he had to do something. So he put his own kid and the kids of some friends in front of the camera.
If you're born in Denmark and you're not of fair skin, you're going to be told you're not Danish. And that's going to be hammered into you. So this is me capturing a moment in order to give a very clear and honest picture to the people who are on the other side of that screen about who it is that they're speaking to.
Sabor thinks of himself as Danish, even though he was raised in California by his mom before moving to Denmark in 1997 to be with his dad. Now he's a 32-year-old creative guy for an ad agency, married to a woman who immigrated to Denmark with her family from Brazil when she was a toddler. Back then, Denmark was a liberal place with a generous welfare system.
I don't really recall having to deal with things like racism, 10 years ago.
Things changed. Denmark's taken a hard line with refugees fleeing Syria. Over the last few years, it put ads in Arabic newspapers telling them to stay away. The country passed a law allowing officials to seize the personal valuables of refugees to compensate for the cost of their care.
The state of, how foreigners get treated is, of course, getting a lot worse. You never know what's going to happen. A family like mine has to have an emergency, exit strategy. Like, oh, okay, what happens if it hits the fan and they start rounding up Muslims and throwing them in camps? What do we have to do then?
While her parents were considering questions like that, Scarlett's growing up. Sabor keeps contrasting her childhood with the one he had in California.
So Scarlett was 4 years old the first time she asked me, "Dad, where am I from?" Same thing as she's come home crying, saying the kids called her a cannibal from the jungle. When I had converted to Islam and she went and told the kids at school and they told her, "Well, yeah, now your dad's a terrorist." And like in the U.S., when I was living in the U.S., I was an illegal alien my entire time that I was living there. And I was living there for 14 years. And I don't recall that I ever asked my mom about being Muslim, about being a foreigner. Because in the U.S., you come into the U.S. and you know what? You're American.
Because the word American doesn't necessarily imply one specific culture. But it might not work that way with the word Danish in Denmark.
I tell people, like, when they say, "Well, the Muslim culture isn't Danish culture." I'm like, "Well, I understand that. And I'll accept that as an answer. But then again, let's go and look at the kids. What are they dressed like? they're dressing like Drake and they're dressing like The Weeknd. And I mean, being vegan isn't a, or a vegetarian isn't a Danish thing, but look at how many people are doing that. And, you know, practicing yoga and mindfulness, that's not a Danish culture either. Technology has brought us all close together, and there's a group of people that don't want to accept and are out of touch with the fact that the world is changing, and that's not necessarily a bad thing.
People have attacked Sabor for using children to make that point.
People were concerned about the children's safety. There was a lot of this, is it okay to use kids in a political debate? And that's straight, you know, political spin doctoring. I know all the kids since they were babies, and I know their families very well. So, you know, we have a daily dialogue with everybody to make sure everything is okay. There's been death threats. There's been a lot of, you know, very, very ugly comments. I've had things sent to my house that I'm not particularly happy about. We could very easily come to the States. But is it going to be much better over there? Are we better off in a Trump U.S. than in Denmark? And I don't know. I mean, if we look all around the world, I mean, how I'm feeling as a Muslim man in Denmark, my plight is the same as a Muslim man in Holland, or the same as a Muslim man in Idaho. I mean, it's the same story.
I can't help seeing all of this from Scarlett's point of view. When I was her age, the American identity became my haven. If I had been denied that, I don't know who I would have been or who I'd be now. It's frankly a terrifying thought. I didn't realize until I saw Scarlett crying that what she's experiencing now is my worst nightmare.
The World's Rupa Shenoy there with an excerpt from the current episode of her podcast, Otherhood. Definitely worth your time. You can find Otherhood on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Marco Werman. A community group in Buffalo, New York, helps many people in the city, including immigrants, insulate their homes. But
in the age of Trump, we are certainly affected. We are currently in a hiring freeze because we don't know what's going to happen with a lot of policy changes that are going to come from the federal government to us.
That story still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. A lot of factors usually come together to create the conditions for a famine. And right now, four nations, Somalia, South Sudan, Nigeria, and Yemen, are facing the threat of famine at the same time. The United Nations calls the situation the worst humanitarian crisis since World War II, potentially affecting 20 million people.
The sun is beating down day after day in these places, and there's no sign of rain on the horizon.
That's Jeffrey Gettleman, East Africa Bureau Chief for The New York Times. He recently returned from a trip to the drought-plagued town of Baidoa in Somalia.
It's incredibly dry. The land is very dusty, stony. What little grass is dry, yellow, brittle. The sun has been beating down for months. In many of these places, there's no clouds in the sky. It's just piercing sunlight from sunrise to sunset, very hot. Rivers are drying up. Crops have failed. People are not able to get clean water to drink, and they're getting sick from diseases like cholera. Then they pack into these camps that sort of pop up overnight, and those camps really don't have much either. There's little food or water in them. So then you have all these people who are sick, their immunity systems are compromised, and diseases quickly spread.
This scene is actually duplicated in the other three countries we mentioned, South Sudan, Nigeria, and Yemen. We tend to think of famine as a lack of food, but would you say the key element now in all these places is that they're lacking water, clean drinking water?
Famines have happened from time to time, and the aid community is constantly trying to learn from the last one. And this was a big lesson in the famine of 2011, was that many people died from lack of clean water, not from lack of food. And they can trace this with these complicated mapping schemes where they look at where most of the deaths were concentrated in the last famine. And they weren't in these parched desert areas where nomads roam around looking for grass or for water. They were in cities where people were concentrated and they had some water, but it was very dirty. And that led to the spread of disease. And so now the effort is to try to address that directly and say, okay, this isn't just about food. This is about sanitation, hygiene, and clean drinking water. And that changes the response a little bit, but it also makes it harder because it's much harder to airlift water than it is sacks of grain.
Okay, I mean, this becomes obviously a vicious cycle in these refugee camps and their clinics. Tell us about someone you met who is dealing with cholera and what they're facing right now.
Picture a tent with a canvas roof and a sort of bare dirt floor and people lying on stretchers. And often they're with the relatives, and you see somebody trying to fan the flies and keep somebody cool as they're lying on the ground. And I talked to one man who was hunched over a very, very old woman. And I asked him who he was and what was going on. And the woman was his mother. And she looked, I mean, her face almost looked like a skeleton. Very deep eye sockets, very sharp cheekbones, very, very little flesh. And this man was patiently using this homemade fan to get the flies off her. And he said that she had gotten sick in her village and that he had helped carry her to this treatment center. And at the treatment center, there really isn't much. There's a few IVs, some doctors or nurses that look at patients, but often they're very far along in this cholera disease, and it's difficult to bring them back. This is happening all across Somalia, and it's also happening in these other countries like Nigeria and South Sudan.
What kind of scenarios are aid officials looking at if things don't improve? Like just on the waterfront, if things don't improve there, what happens next?
The worry is you could have hundreds of thousands of people dying at the same time from these diseases, which are very preventable. Cholera can be treated with oral rehydration salts and IVs if it's caught early enough. And it can be stopped from spreading if people are washing their hands and eliminating the bacteria instead of spreading it person to person. So the scenarios could be really bad. You could have major death in several areas at once.
And for the nation of South Sudan, which is also facing famine, the youngest nation in the world, is it basically already a failed state after just a few years?
South Sudan is not in a good position right now. Just this weekend, six aid workers were killed in an ambush trying to go to their jobs delivering aid in a rural part of South Sudan. They were civilians that were caught up in a robbery. The circumstances aren't even clear, and they were killed on the side of the road. So South Sudan has many problems. It's got a political vacuum at the center. It's got tens of thousands of young men with arms who are fighting each other. And now it's got this big problem of how to deliver aid to these very needy areas. And if you have six aid workers killed at one moment, that just scares and terrifies all the other aid groups from trying to deliver aid. And that becomes a big, big problem of how can you even get supplies into these areas if the aid workers aren't welcome and they're going to lose their lives trying to do that.
Jeffrey Gettleman is based in Nairobi, Kenya, and covers sub-Saharan Africa for The New York Times. Thank you very much for your time, Jeffrey.
Glad to help.
Our data team's been working on different ways to visualize the current famine crisis and why modern famines are man-made disasters. You can see maps of the crisis and data on how it's expected to get worse at PRI.org. Let's focus now on something else that's at risk because of war and famine in East Africa specifically, Sudanese culture. That's what brought Dominique Raimondo to the Kakuma refugee camp in Kenya. Thousands of South Sudanese are there now. Raimondo himself is from South Sudan but now lives in Salt Lake City. And he went to Kakuma to learn how the culture of the Dinka people is being affected by the current crisis. The Dinka are from an area of South Sudan just north of the Kenyan border. And Raimondo wanted to record their songs and dances at the camp. The trip was sponsored by the Association for Cultural Equity, the nonprofit founded by the late musicologist and producer Alan Lomax. It's now run by his daughter, Anna Lomax Wood. Raimondo says Dinka culture is at risk for a simple reason.
The small kids that are there, they are not interested in practicing the culture anymore. And I actually asked, you know, the elders, how would the Dinka traditional culture stay the same if the situation is the same as I can see now? And they say, yes, because of the factors in the refugee camp, there is a danger that our culture will disappear.
So at the same time this is all happening, the people are continuing to arrive in the refugee camp in Kenya from South Sudan because there's famine, because there's civil war. I mean, can it be preserved in those kind of circumstances?
It's true, you know, because of the situation in South Sudan, there is a huge number of people coming in the refugee camp. As you can understand, these people are having a lot of issues. You know, some of them are traumatized. But as I went there, I actually lightened their hearts, and they felt that there is a way they can still regain the energy and start practicing the culture, you know, and music, so that it would be the same as it was in the village they came from.
This feels like the moment where we should listen to some of what you recorded in the field at the refugee camp in Kenya. So a lot of what you discovered was just pure rhythm. So I'd like us to listen first to something with a melody. So Dominic, what is this song about? I mean, it's got a melody. Did you speak with anyone who gave you some context?
Yes, Marcos, that's a very powerful song in, you know, the Dinka tribe. The song sings about warriors, you know, who were heading to the village, and so they send a message to the enemies. They said, "We are going to fight all the way to the end, and we're not going to give up." That's what the song means.
Presumably, it's a pretty old song, and is it getting kind of new, fresh context with the war in South Sudan?
It's actually a new song.
Oh, it's new.
And also have some old meaning, because the Dinka tribe, these are, you know, cattle-raising community. They are
cattle,
always so. The warriors in the community, in the Dinka tribe, have to step up and protect their community.
So I mentioned that some of these songs are very rhythmic, almost pure rhythm. Let's hear one of those. So, Dominic, what intrigued me most when I heard this was whether this is a form of communication or not, and who is talking to whom.
That's the Didinga traditional dance called apiti. And apiti is mostly, you know, performed by the women. And they are telling the men that we are moving to our father's home, and we will be waiting there for you to come and find us.
How eager were the refugees in the camp in Kenya? How eager were they to share this music with you?
Well, it was amazing, you know, how they responded. You know, they say they have never have anybody coming from the United States to come and record the music with the locals. The situation was overwhelming. So it was something new that they have seen, you know, been recorded. So it was welcoming, and it was very good.
Dominic Raimundo, thank you very much for being with us and for telling us about your trip to Kenya. Thank you.
Thank you, Marcos.
We're going to have Obamacare for the foreseeable future, as the dust was settling on Friday. That's how Speaker Paul Ryan summed up the Republican health care debacle in the House of Representatives. But that doesn't mean the push to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act is over for good. And in the meantime, states and cities around the country are still trying to figure out what makes sense for them locally. Leaders in San Francisco say the answer is universal health care for everyone in the city, regardless of immigration status. That, in short, is what a program called Healthy San Francisco is all about. It's been around for a decade already, and some say it's a model that could be adopted in other places around the U.S. Barbara Garcia is Director of Health for the City and County of San Francisco. First of all, can you just explain to us, like, really simply, how does this program work?
Well, Healthy San Francisco, when we created it 10 years ago, was simply a access program, in that all of the providers in the community, in the county, came together and made a commitment to all of the uninsured in the community to, one, provide medical homes to all of the uninsured who applied.
That's kind of extraordinary, because a lot of people opposed to universal health care say it's too expensive. So how do you do that?
Well, we had general funds that were able to do that. But if you do not provide primary care and prevention services, then your expenses are going to be at your emergency room. So we found that investing upfront with prevention, primary care, has saved us along the line.
And how do you respond to people who say that taxpayer money should not be funding programs that help undocumented immigrants, even health care programs?
Well, I would just say that HIV, TB do not know the difference between an undocumented person and a documented person. And San Francisco has always been committed, particularly as we were an epicenter of HIV. That gave us the know-how and also the commitment that we could not discriminate against individuals based on their immigration status, because that does not solve a health problem.
Is there an argument to be made that taking care of the health of undocumented immigrants actually helps the rest of society?
Well, I've been in this field for over 35 years. Particularly, I served undocumented farm workers for over 20 years. And what we found was that as we provided care to individuals, everyone became healthier, particularly for a workforce like farm workers, where a healthy workforce doesn't help you in your production of food. So I believe that investing in all people, particularly on the prevention and primary care side, is a great investment into the rest of the community.
San Francisco is a sanctuary city, correct?
That's right.
So how concerned are you that Washington will just go after sanctuary cities and all the benefits they provide?
Well, we're concerned, but I do think that it's important that as a city we continue to fight for those who are here. We know that the federal government may be looking at how to reduce the funding, and, you know, we can't predict what it looks like, but we can say that we're going to attempt to try to continue to provide the level of service in the city that we have for the future.
I'm curious, the Healthy San Francisco program, would it translate easily for the whole state of California or other cities across the U.S., and do you think right now is the time to be thinking about this kind of stuff?
Well, we had started that conversation internally in the city and the county when all of this conversation was happening about repeal and replace. And so, yes, I do think that a type of model like this could be effective in terms of ensuring that people have prevention services as well as medical homes. Again, it's access programs. They're not insurance. We know insurance is much better. So we'll have that conversation again if this continues to rise its head.
And Barbara, as far as staying healthy, I gather you are kind of the perfect role model for director of health for the city of San Francisco. You are 5 feet tall and you can deadlift 320 pounds.
Yeah, that's right. I'm a power lifter and I've been doing that for almost a decade. So that's part of investing into your own personal health and also staying strong for this kind of an administration coming, trying to mess around with health care in San Francisco.
Yeah, well, with those kind of stats, I am inclined to believe anything you say.
Thank you so much.
Barbara Garcia, Director of Health for the City and County of San Francisco. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. The recent history of Buffalo, New York, is like that of a lot of Rust Belt cities in America. Manufacturers left the area, then came a huge decrease in population and an increase in poverty. And it's been tough trying to get out of that cycle. But in Buffalo, there are some community activists who are giving it their best shot. Many of them are immigrants and refugees. They're working off the simple idea that sustainable housing saves people money and fights climate change. Trouble is, their work may be at risk in the age of Trump. The World's Jason Margolis has that story from Buffalo.
When you're poor, you have to make tough choices. Bob Cook learned that lesson a few years back when he lost his job.
Because I couldn't afford to pay my heat bill, my gas got turned off. But I had to stay warm by using a small electric heater and have a blanket around myself to stay warm in the winter. And this happens to families.
Buffalo is a cold city, a poor city, and a city with a lot of old homes. Today, Cook has a new job. He works with Push Buffalo, a community-based organization that helps low-income residents weatherize their homes.
Our program talks to anybody who wants to look at getting insulation.
On a windy winter day, we walk the streets of Buffalo's Lower West Side, a neighborhood rich with immigrants and refugees. It's where PUSH, which stands for People United for Sustainable Housing, concentrates its work.
And this is Za's place.
Za Nguyen runs a small recycling center. His shop looks like an old convenience store, now bursting with thousands of empty cans and bottles.
Originally, I'm from Bama.
How long have you lived in Buffalo?
Almost 11 years now.
Nguyen pays people a nickel for a can or bottle, then turns those in for an extra 3.5 cents. He squeaks out a living, but has trouble paying his heating bills. Most months, he cuts deals with the local utility.
We pay whatever we can.
One of Wynn's customers nods his head as we talk.
That's my heat always, you know, expensive, you know.
Siswan Tunglasamiti is originally from Laos. He now works sewing embroidery on baseball hats. I asked both men if their houses are insulated. Neither seems certain.
Probably not own houses, probably don't have no insulation
now,
or something like that.
This is probably a house we should come and talk to this guy and say, here's a program that could help you to get your house insulated.
Push talks to a lot of guys like this, like Dave Figueroa.
Actually, they insulated my house.
Figueroa is 61. He's a former contractor who had to stop working after liver and kidney transplants. He says before Push insulated his home, he just wore a lot of clothes around the house during winter. What other choice was there?
I live on SSI, you know, Social Security, so it was, you know, a little hard keeping up with the bills. And once I got it insulated, it made a world of difference. World of difference, you know. My bills were like, you know, up in the 300s monthly, you know, and now I pay something like, you know, $140, $150 a month.
Push Buffalo has insulated about 500 homes around the city. It's also installing solar panels on homes so people can generate their own electricity. And Push doesn't just help immigrants get a better foothold here. Immigrants also help run the organization.
I was born in Eritrea, and I lived there until I was 5 years old. I was born in the middle of a civil war.
Rawa Gurmatsian is Push Buffalo's deputy director. In the 1980s, her family was among Buffalo's first wave of refugees.
And in the last 15 years, we've really seen just a huge influx of immigrants and refugees coming from all over the world. If you go to the local school that's about four blocks away, you can hear 60 different languages being spoken there.
They're coming to Buffalo in large part for the homes.
It's the second largest city in America being resettled right now, and mostly because of our housing stock. It's a city that is designed for a population of about 600,000 people, and we're currently at about 289,000.
That translates into a lot of abandoned houses. Push Buffalo has bought and upgraded many of them and brings multiple questions to each project.
Is this going to produce good jobs? Is this going to help community residents? Is it going to reduce climate emissions into the air? Is it something that's going to be good for our neighborhood?
Buffalo needs the help. It's the third poorest major city in the U.S., only behind Cleveland and Detroit. But walking around Buffalo's Lower West Side, the homes and parks appear to be in much better shape than other parts of the city. Push deserves much of the credit for what's happening here, but of course its programs cost a lot of money. I ask Gurmatsian where it all comes from.
Wow, who funds us? Everybody.
It's the usual mix of individuals, foundations, and government support, including direct and indirect funding from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. But help from Washington is now a concern. President Trump wants to slash the EPA's budget. He's especially targeting programs addressing climate change and energy efficiency programs across the federal government.
In the age of Trump, we are certainly affected. We are currently in a hiring freeze because we don't know what's going to happen with a lot of policy changes that are going to come from the federal government to us.
But she adds the age of Trump also brings increased attention to what they do and why it's important. She says that whoever's in the White House, their mission remains the same. Make Buffalo a cleaner and more livable place for all its residents. For The World, Jason Margolis, Buffalo.
The age of Trump is also bringing some new appreciation to what artists and musicians are thinking and performing, like this man from Mexico. This is the sound of Liber Terán. He's rock royalty in Mexico, founded the band Los de Abajo in 1992, and was its vocalist for 15 years. He was influenced by smart 90s rock acts like Jane's Addiction and the French band Mano Negra, the brainchild of Manu Chao. Makes perfect sense. A big influence on Manu Chao, The Clash. You can hear that distantly on tracks like this one, El Gitano Western.
El gitano western no te vino a tocar una polca que te hará.
Libre Tehran's most recent release is a best of collection, so it's a great place to discover what this dazzling musical mind has been up to and where he's headed. We'll leave you with something new from Libre Tehran, the single off his new CD. Apuntando al Cielo, or Pointing to the Sky, the latest from Mexican musician Libre Tehran. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, and we're back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.